bit of background. The conscience clause, statutory provision, allows healthcare professionals to refuse to provide certain medical treatments on the basis of their religious or moral beliefs. Both Congress and state legislatures began to enact conscience clauses following the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade in 1973. Today, conscience clauses can be found in almost every state and, of course, in the United States Code. Early provisions allow doctors and nurses to refuse to perform abortions and sterilizations. But today's provisions are much broader. Conscience clauses today extend protections to pharmacists and healthcare institutions. Folks or entities covered by conscience clauses can now refuse to participate in matters ranging from abortion to assisted reproduction, from circumcision to termination of life support. The proliferation of conscience clauses eliminates an underlying tension that's been characterized alternately as patient access versus religious freedom, patient autonomy versus provider autonomy, public obligation versus private obligation. These questions are not just academic. As recounted in the literature and the cases, these have real life-changing consequences for people seeking health care provision, especially in locations where access is relatively limited. This evening's debate is particularly apt for a year in which conscience clause issues have been widely reported in the news. At the end of his administration, President George W. Bush implemented the provider refusal rule, which prohibits recipients of federal funds from discriminating against healthcare workers who refuse to provide health services or information on the basis of their moral or religious beliefs. In February, President Barack Obama's administration served notice that intended to rescind the rule. Within 2 weeks ago, in a speech before the joint session of Congress, the president declared that, quote, federal conscience laws will remain in place, close quote, as part of his health care reform proposal. In light of these recent events, and with the potential for major health care over the coming months, there's never been a better time to discuss these issues and to discuss what, if any, conscience clauses should play in our society. The way in which it resolves these issues will determine the extent to which we respect both religious liberty of the healthcare providers and the ability of patients to access healthcare services. Tonight, we're very fortunate to have two experts in this area. Kevin Seamus Hassan is the founder and president of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. It's a religious law firm that protects the right of free expression of all religious traditions. And writes frequently in the media on religious liberty. Prior to founding Beckett, Mr. Hassan litigated religious liberty cases at Williams and Connolly in Washington, D.C. And from 1986 to 1987, he served in the Office of Legal Counsel of the Department of Justice, where he advised the Reagan administration on matters of church and state. He is the author, seems to be open on the table, entitled The Right to Be Wrong, Culture War Over Religion in America. We have also, we're honored to Marcy A. Hamilton, who is the holder of the Paul R. Kyle Chair in Public Law at the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law. And she's one of the nation's leading scholars on the intersection of law and religion. She focuses particularly on whether the public should accommodate religious practices that would otherwise violate the law. Professor Hamilton is a former law clerk to Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and was lead counsel for the city of Bernie, Texas, in Bernie v. Flores, the seminal Supreme Court case holding the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to be unconstitutional. In addition to her many other accomplishments, Professor Hamilton is the author of the book God versus Gavel, Religion and the Rule of Law. So we're quite fortunate to have these two experts with us tonight. And the format will be as follows. Seamus will start with 20 minutes. Professor Hamilton will follow. Professor Seamus will then do 5 minutes of rebuttal, and Mossy will do 5 minutes after that. And after that, we look forward to your questions and answers. Have I misspoke?
I just mentioned that this Federalist Society event is part of the 10th of the series on freedom of national dialogue.
And we are indeed grateful to the John Templeton Foundation for supporting this service. To begin, Your Holiness.
No one's going to talk about that. Do forgive me for speaking sitting down. You also may notice that I'm shaking a bit. This is not because I'm afraid of you. It's not because I'm afraid of Chief Judge Pressler. And it's certainly not because I'm afraid of Marcy. Because I'm afraid of Reuben. This is the only thing that Michael J. Fox and I have in common. Parkinson's is good for some things. I make a much better martini now that I have Parkinson's. It's a great excuse for a bad golf game. Truth be told, my golf game is no worse than it ever was. But people used to point at me and say, would you look at that? He's trying to play golf. Or they'd point at me and say, would you look at that? He's trying to play golf. And get good parking spaces. That's about the extent of it. I really can't recommend Parkinson's to anybody, especially in the public speaking business. So bear with me and we'll get through it. If you start with the question, should conscience clauses be allowed or should they be disallowed? Should pharmacists be allowed to refuse to give contraceptives to patience and rebuke, one tends to have no sense of perspective on the enormity of the question that's at stake. If one starts at the beginning, back when the colonies were still the colonies, one risks the boredom that sometimes follows from history. But I don't think we'll be in much danger at this time, at least I hope not. Because that really puts perspective on why it is as a nation we value conscience at all. And why we value conscience at all is the name of the game. In the 1650s, Quakerism erupted in England as the most radical, as that day, the most radical expression of the English Reformation. And the Quakers were interesting people. They were strict pacifists, they couldn't swear oaths, and they did not respect the authority of any clergy or even scripture. They only respected the authority of what was called the inner light, God's presence immediately in their hearts. So when you get enough people walking around together, each of whom is following his inner light, interesting things begin to happen. The inner light had been known to lead Quakers to turn up naked in Anglican services, shouting democracy. In this particular example, really did not sit well at all with the good Puritans in Massachusetts Bay or the separate Puritans in Plymouth Colony. So before there were any Quakers in the Western Hemisphere, they moved to outlaw Quakerism. And Massachusetts Bay enacted statute after statute imposing penalties on the Quakers should they ever arrive. And lo and behold, they turned up the inner light, sent some of them over for everyone. And the first penalty was to be flogged and thrown out, and flogged and thrown out. And the inner lights had to come back. So when they came back, they appalled Prince Puritan fathers, passed another statute that said, for first offense, they'll have their left ear cut off. For second offense, they'll have the right ear cut off. For third offense, they'll have the tongue bored through with a hot iron. And all those things were done to the Quakers, and the inner light said to come back, so they did. Whereupon, they enacted a statute with the death penalty for being Quaker, and solemnly, legally hanged 4 people, including most famously Mary Dyer.
Trial Christians, justice divorce,
Well, that could be Parkinson's or...
It's a microphone, I think it's too close.
All right. Most famously, Mary Dyer was executed for being Quaker in Massachusetts Bay. Now, along the way, other colonies didn't take quite that radical approach to the Quakers, but all of them wanted to outlaw something or another about the Quakers. 11 of the original 13 colonies would not respect their refusal to bear arms. All 13 would not respect, initially anyway, their refusal to swear oaths. Now, not swearing oaths and affirming instead of swearing is so much part of our legal background radiation that it goes unnoticed, especially in a century that's very different from the 17th century, where oaths are quaint things that have to do with a calculated risk of a perjury conviction rather than 17th century conviction, you're holding one's eternal soul and one's hands and trembling to do so. Thomas More went to his death, of course, refusing to take an oath he didn't believe in. Those were pope things in the 17th century. They were the only guarantee of good behavior when no one was looking. They were the only guarantee of loyalty. Refusing to take an oath was a momentous thing. It was taking oneself out of society in a very meaningful way. But the Quakers were adamant everywhere they would not take oaths. And so all sorts of bad things started happening. They would forfeit their cows, they would forfeit their hunting rifles, they would forfeit their property. Ultimately, they would forfeit basically everything they had. And after about a century of gentle, stubborn people refusing to take an oath and losing everything they had for it, some bright light tumbled to the fact that these guys are likely to be pretty trustworthy even without an oath. And it's just not so, there's nothing in this for us trying to force them to take an oath when they'll do a substitute action like affirm. These are people, very principled people, who would rather lose everything they have than disobey their conscience. So, eventually, Article 6 of the Constitution enshrines in the Constitution itself the right of people, Quakers, to affirm instead of taking oath. While all this is playing out, there's a parallel sequence going on with military service. No colony had a standing army. There's no such thing as standing armies in those days. They all had militia. Think of the militia as a volunteer fire department for the military, and you've got it. When the bell rang, every able-bodied man grabbed his hunting rifle and his ammunition and rushed out to the barricades. There were local Indian wars, commonly, and five people in a village of 100 refusing to fight made a big, significant difference. Whether the battle was ultimately won or lost, more to the point, made a significant difference in God's dividend that people would come back unharmed. This was not some no-cost, low-impact religious exercise. This was a very expensive claim that the Quakers were making. And they went to their deaths, literally hung by their thumbs. They were, all sorts of horrendous things went on in America under the flying the flag of the rule of law, forced these guys to violate their consciences. It came to the Civil War in the South and the North finally recognized the right of religious exemption from military service. Madison himself, by the way, tried to insert it into what would become the Second Amendment. In his draft of the Second Amendment, he said, as in militia language, no one religiously scrupulous of bearing arms shall be forced to serve in the military. Congress didn't pick that up, but it shows Madison's thinking in the matter. When When the Civil War was over, Lincoln had proclaimed conscientious objection to be available to religious pacifists, and the South had done the same. From that point on, it became an accepted part of American military history. It was for religious conscientious objectors only until Vietnam. The Supreme Court broadened the scope of who was entitled to this protection from just religious believers, to people for whom pacifism occupies an analogous space in the personal philosophy to religion or being the life of a believer. Whether that was a wise move or whether it was a legitimate move, Professor Hamilton and I may disagree with. I don't think we disagree that the Supreme Court at the time never dreamed conscientious objection was somehow wrong in itself. It was somehow immoral, somehow contrary to the theory of the Constitution. In fact, to say otherwise is to really pull one of the central threads out of the early constitutional experience in Article 6. Now, remember Catch-22? Remember Yassarian in Catch-22? Yassarian had a perfectly good complaint of thought. He wanted to not fly combat missions. And his superior, I think it was Major, if I remember correctly, asked him why in the world he wouldn't fly combat missions. And Yassarian said, well, they're trying to kill me. And Major's response was, they're trying to kill everybody. To which Yassarian replied, what difference does that make? And Yassarian's got a point of sorts. By what right can the state force them to go in harm's way? And Major, of course, had a point as well. The conventional wisdom is that when the state is under attack, all its citizens are under attack, and the state can conscript all its citizens to defend it. But the state wasn't conscripting all its citizens to defend it. It was exempting, at that time, conscientious religious observers and religious objectors only. Yassarian had said, I just can't kill those guys who are trying to kill me because they'd see if they're on the ground and they're dead. He didn't say that. He just said, it's crazy. I don't want to do this. It's dangerous. In a similar way, people today who think the Iraq War is dumb, people who think it's too expensive, people who think it's counterproductive, still have to fight. Only the people with conscientious objection to war, and to all war at that, that are exempted. But why should that be? Why should it be that only people with conscientious objection get to stay safely on the ground, where people who know the war to be dumb, think it's just too dangerous, etc., etc., have to fly with the Yassarian? Well, it's because we as a people learned what the Quakers taught. Conscience is a quintessential human thing. It's where integrity lives. And it is what we must follow if we are to maintain our integrity. It's what tells us, speaks to us of truth, speaks to us of duty, and offers to serve as a referee on what's in and what's out. And by continuing to let people serve in the military, or not serve in the military according to their conscience, we continue to recognize the value of that factor in our public calculus. Now, to bring it quickly to conscience clauses, if we as a people are prepared to let citizens sit out wars, why in the world can we let them sit out prescriptions? Imagine a doctor being told that despite his conscience, he has to administer a lethal injection as part of capital punishment. Did anybody say a doctor should go to jail and lose his license for refusing to administer a lethal injection? I don't think so. For someone whose conscience says abortion is the same thing, we don't have to agree with them. That's the same thing. But for someone whose conscience says abortion is the same thing, the answer should be the same. For someone who says that a morning after pill is just a very early abortion, we don't have to agree with them either. But the conscience is the same, the result should be the same. Principled people are an asset to our society, not a liability. They're expensive as an asset. They're much more expensive back in the colonies when we're 5% or 10% of a township wouldn't fight. But they're an expense that's really a bargain. Because there are worse things than having untidy laws with too many principled people running around and too many exemptions. The worst thing is having too few principled people to maintain a cohesive society. So, Professor Hamilton and I have debated many times over the years, and I think I have anything to what she's going to say. But I think what it boils down to is, for her, the 17th century, the good old days. Here's my scene.
Society for including me. It's always a pleasure to speak to Federalist Society events, which I do on a very regular basis. And thank you for your generous introduction, Judge Prescott. I appreciate that. I'm very glad to hear that we are going to revisit the history of the 17th century for the following reason. We have a dominant debate in the United States, at least we did during the Bush era, that this is a Christian country, as though it was a singular religious set of believers. And I am very glad to hear the emphasis today on the fact that religious believers did not get along in the early years of the United States. And there was more dissension, mutual disapproval, than there was unity. And the Quakers were victims, no question about it, in Massachusetts, but they were also willing to take the power in Pennsylvania, where you couldn't hold public office unless you were a Quaker. Why? Because only the Quakers had seen the true light, and nobody else had. So I'm not sure what we get out of the founding era with respect to diversity, except for the fact that the one thing that you can say about the United States from beginning until now, and what's become more intense over time, is diversity. There's remarkable diversity among religious believers. And I highly recommend Diana Eck's work at Harvard, in which she's documenting the vast numbers of varieties of religious faith that now populate the United States. And it is a tribute to the system that was put in place at the time of the framing, and that has found fruition now. The debate tonight on conscience clauses in the healthcare field, because I don't think anybody is debating anymore whether or not there ought to be conscience clauses with respect to war. We pretty much settled down to, if you have a belief like a Quaker, in other words, you're opposed to all war, you can have an exemption from serving in the United States military. If you object to only one war, you can't have an exemption. But if you object to all, you can. But that's settled out. Whether or not that's fair or not, and whether or not that's consistent with general principles of logic, that's in place. And I don't think anybody's going to debate that. The question before us that I thought we were going to address is whether or not pharmacists must give the lead case right now is Storman's out of the Ninth Circuit. And the question is, must a pharmacist, when a woman comes into the pharmacy with a prescription or a request for Plan B, which is the morning after Phil, must the pharmacist hand over the bill? That's really the question. And the federal government under President Bush provided for conscience clause or exemptions for religious believers in a number of states in a wide variety of ways have provided for exemptions. But I think the first thing that we need to get off the table is that there's no constitutional requirement. The courts simply have not gone there as they shouldn't. There's no constitutional requirement that requires a free exercise exemption for refusing to provide medication of any sort. It's not constitutionally required. And the Ninth Circuit in Storman's case reversed the district court trying to say that if you're a pharmacist, that somehow you have been injured under constitutional principles. And the question here is all about permissible accommodation, and should the government provide exemptions for healthcare workers, whether they be nurses or pharmacists or doctors, et cetera. And our law is filled with exemptions for religious believers because our legislatures have been open, as the existence of the federal and the state conscience clauses show, they've been very open to providing exemptions for religious believers. And so really it ends up being a matter at one level of just public policy, right? What is the public policy in terms of, let's just focus on Plan B, on providing Plan B to a woman who has had unprotected sex, whether it's by accident or by rape, should she be able to obtain Plan B within 72 hours within which it will be effective? And on the one hand, it's just a question of feasibility, right? Is there a way to make the system work so that that pharmacists object, don't have to handle it, right? And one way that's been worked out is Wisconsin, where a pharmacist cannot tear up their prescription in front of the woman and tell her that she's going to hell, but must hand that prescription to a referring pharmacy or to another pharmacist. That's really the question in these debates. Should there be a right for the pharmacist to refuse to hand over the medication when there is a middle ground to get the medication to the woman in these circumstances? But as usual, if you look at the title of this debate, and as usual, when we discuss religious liberty in the United States, the focus was intended to be on just the provider, that the only one with rights in the picture is the provider. And so we need to be concerned about the pharmacist, we need to be concerned about the nurse, we need to be concerned about the doctor, their religious liberty, and somehow that's the end of the discourse. But that's not accurate, because the woman who is asking for birth control in the form of Plan B is asking for something that is in the realm of constitutional protection. The state cannot refuse to permit her to get contraception under Griswold. But we don't even have to go to Roe v. Wade. We don't have to get to abortion. Let's just stay at Griswold. And so what you have is a woman who has a constitutional right to have some access to birth control in the state over and against a provider who is claiming the right not to provide it. So we are not dealing with a one-sided exchange. We're dealing with two individuals, each claiming rights in the circumstance, and that's what the legislatures should be considering. Not just the provider, not just the religious interest, but also the woman's interest in obtaining birth control and obtaining her own health. In addition, there are two religious players in these scenarios. There is the pharmacist and there is the woman. The woman brings to the counter her own set of religious beliefs, and there are plenty of religious believers in the United States who believe that contraception following unprotected sex is perfectly religiously acceptable, and even more than that, permitting a child to be conceived after a rape, or after incest, or after unexpected, unprotected sex is immoral and inappropriate. So what I'd really like to emphasize is, as usual, the law is not dividing just the rights of a believer, and the believer's not the only player in the picture. You've got to have all the players in the picture, and that's the question that legislators should be looking at as they decide whether or not to provide this permissible accommodation or not. It's not constitutionally required, as I said, but so the question is it a good thing? I think that with respect to the policy, there is a real question as to what the federal government and the states are saying in these circumstances. Because, for example, in the Storman's case, the question was licensing as a pharmacist. Can you be a pharmacist, and be licensed to be a pharmacist, if you refuse to provide otherwise legal medication? And so the question is there an entitlement under United States thinking, because it's not constitutionally required, but is there an entitlement for an individual to refuse to perform part of their professional activity? And that, I think that is an important question, and it's one that's hardly ever really debated. And I actually think that we are in a very, very difficult time in the United States because of the culture of entitlement and the notion that every individual is entitled, and then just create the list from the internal perspective of the individual. And I think the entitlement perspective is exactly at the heart, unfortunately, of some of the arguments that are made that if a person cannot fulfill the requirements of a profession, that they have a right to that profession, even though they cannot fulfill the requirements of the profession. That just seems problematic. But let me just close with the following. You know, healthcare reform, of course, is nothing but a black box. There's no 1,000-page statute in the world that's anything but a black box. You could be an expert in any number of areas, and you would never know what the healthcare package or whatever it is going to be called is and contains. But what's been fascinating for me is the ability of religious groups to push through exemptions rather automatically through the healthcare reform debate, when everyone seemed to think this was about the insurance companies and whether or not you can deny someone for pre-existing conditions. But it turns out the religious entities have been very effective, and they have not only the conscience clause is now locked into the bill that's now at play, which permits healthcare providers to not provide the healthcare that they otherwise would. It also contains an exemption for parents who believe in faith healing from having to get health insurance for their children. They're obligated to take medical care of their children. But under this bill, they don't have to buy the health insurance that every single other American must purchase. So what I take from the healthcare debate, which is what is documented across the board in the United States, is that exemptions are not difficult to obtain for religious groups. They've done extraordinarily well in a wide variety, including with respect to the conscience clause. But I think that we need to have a public debate about the interests of the individual being denied and not just the interests of the religious believer. And my final point, and this is an issue that has been utterly abandoned by the Republicans, but perhaps they'll return to it at some point, is which government should be regulating healthcare issues, and which government should be regulating whether or not there will be conscience clauses. Should it be the federal government or the states? Right now, we have double levels at work with the federal and the states. I would posit that federalism should be at play here, and this is an issue that belongs in the state legislatures, where we can have a 50-state experiment and figure out what's the best balance for everybody involved, and it's unfortunate that it's being regulated from the federal level. Thanks.
Thank you.
Although we just took over the Stormer case. We are petition for a hearing in our veterans' petition. Raised indeed with it as a constitutional issue. It's not at all obvious. This is not a constitutional question. If the state wants to compel someone to perform something that his or her conscience says he may not, there's no reason in the world that's not a good sense. It's not however it's decided. It's a free exercise case in form. And it's a very important point that we took the case to specifically to make. It's true that the Supreme Court has held that there was a right to abortion in Missouri, Texas, and contraceptives. Those are rights against the state government or the federal government. Those are rights against government actors. They're not rights against individual businesses, private citizens. And I have a 14th Amendment right to life that's just as valid as the right to liberty that gives rise to the Amendment. Right to an abortion. And if I don't run out of Parkinson's meds more than 24 hours without them, I go to the abortions and I can die. My federally protected right to life against the government does not guarantee me that any pharmacy I stumble across has to carry my meds. And for that matter, it's pretty obvious that not every pharmacy has to carry contraceptives. This is a business matter. Have you seen a pharmacy in a retirement community? They don't carry birth control pills. Even though Abraham and Sarah might come visiting, it's not good business. There's no reason they should, and if they can deny it for a business reason, they can deny it for non-business reason as well. Rights of the woman, religious views of the woman, are of course about the Becker Fund defends the free expression of all religious traditions. We defend everyone from Anglicans to Zoroastrians, literally, for the past 15 years. Batting 850 doing so in the court. We were the people who recently won the right, which Marcy disagrees with, for a gentleman that sacrificed goats in his kitchen in Beulah, Texas. Unless you think with a Christian right, we recently read the Irish Christian right for saying the First Amendment, keeping the right to break the First Amendment. The right of the woman, however, just as the right of the it's a right of the pharmacist, it's a right against the state, not against your fellow citizens. So there's not a calculus involved with her right to free exercise versus his right to free exercise. I think when it all comes down at the end of the day, and all the metaphors that you mix in, to the final analysis, one has to see that what's simply going on is this is just another articulation of the same crisis that's been going on in American society for centuries. What do we do with principled people whose consciences require them to do something that's terribly inconvenient for the rest of us? And the answer we've consistently come to as a country is that we respect their consciences, because it's a price worth paying. I don't think there's anything about this that changes the principle. Thank you.
I guess I'm a little confused by the state action response, given that the question of cases is licensing. The state action comes in through whether or not the pharmacist or the healthcare worker will be licensed. And so that's why the free exercise clause was raised and decided in Storman's case. For those who are interested in the two ends of the spectrum, I highly recommend reading Storman's. The district court opinion takes a free exercise viewpoint, says the pharmacist has a free exercise right, and Ninth Circuit says, no, there's no free exercise right. This is a neutral and generally applicable law with respect to licensing. And I think it lays it out very nicely, but state action is with respect to licensing. And there's no constitutional right to have a license. A license is a privilege, not a right. This is not just about private individuals. It's about whether or not you're going to have the state say that Joe is going to be held out as a licensed pharmacist who knows how to deal with medication and read prescriptions and handle, et cetera, and does the pharmacist have an obligation to provide the medications for which prescriptions and requests are made? That's the question. And in most states, pharmacists do have such requirements. They don't get to pick and choose according to their own lines what medications they'll provide. And this is a relatively new wrinkle in the way these things are handled. Let me just close by saying that I honestly cannot figure out who the principal people are in Seamus's world except the religious people. And I think that the woman standing at the counter is every bit as principal in her decision as to whether or not to get Plan B is the person standing behind the counter who's refusing to give her medication that loses its efficacy in 72 hours. So I don't think we do have a crisis with a public policy question. And finally, I don't think the United States should be particularly proud of its dissension between religious groups and the violence of it at the founding of our country, but the unbelievable success of the American Constitution rests in the fact that we have cultivated 100,000 religious faiths in the same country without a war that has broken out over religious belief. There's something fundamentally strong about the American system that has led to the fact we're not Ireland, we're not the Middle East, and I would say that it has a lot to do with the invasion of the separation of church and state, but that's a different topic. So thanks very much.
Yeah. Of course, licensing is a state action issue. Of course, someone could challenge denial of a license on the one hand for refusing to participate in abortions, for example, just like someone else can. You can it's appropriate standing to make a challenge to the granting of a license. But I don't think we as a society want to be putting ourselves in the position of saying lawyers who can't do the death penalty can't be lawyers. Quakers can't be lawyers because they can't argue for the death penalty. They can't zealously advocate for their client, the government's position, that so-and-so should fry. I don't think we're going to put ourselves in the position of saying doctors who cannot participate in executions shouldn't be doctors, they should lose their licenses because they won't put that lethal injection in the tube. For that same reason, I don't think we should be putting ourselves in the position of saying pharmacists, because of their consciences, can't do something that is absolutely equivalent in their consciences is lethal injection is for the doctor, can't be pharmacists. I think we're better off having principled people of all flavors and professions than we are having just hired guns who will do whatever the profession says to do whenever and salute sharply, regardless of things conscience makes. Conscientious people are an asset to society, not a liability.
The question is not whether or not they're not going to hand over the medication at all. The play right now in the States is whether or not a pharmacist should have a right to tear up the prescription in front of the woman and tell her to go get another one, or whether or not the pharmacist can be required to give that prescription back and to tell the woman where she can get it filled. That's the question. So if Seamus wants to stand by the proposition that you don't even have to do that, then I think that's plainly in violation of just fundamental decency and principle of people. The question is there a middle ground that works for everybody? And at the very least, there should be always a capacity for the woman to get the medication if she needs it. And so that means some pharmacists might be forced to hand over the medication in circumstances where there's no other possibility. And it's that middle ground that's really important right now.
What about the handing back?
I don't think anybody's arguing for the right to tear up the prescription.
That's new.
That's the extreme example.
I thought Beckett Fine did the amicus brief in the Wisconsin case where that was exactly the issue. Or were you the lead litigator? I don't remember. In Wisconsin, they litigated all the way to the top saying, oh, no, the pharmacist has to be able to not even hand back the prescription. The pharmacist said they shouldn't have to refer. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court said, no, you do have to refer.
I don't believe we're in that case, but referral is a different, handing back the prescription is one thing, referral is another. Can you compel someone to say, the euthanasia will not happen there, but down the street you can pay your grandma? No, you can, it's...
Depends on the state law.
It's adult speech, among other things. But the practical reality of life in a Google America, where even the Yellow Pages used to suffice, finding 40,000 pharmacies with phone numbers, answer the phone and answer your question in 10 seconds if you ask, is that only in extreme hypotheticals invented in Planned Parenthood briefs does it really come down to the fact that one woman desperately needed one pill from one pharmacist with contrary suggestion against it. It's a law school law review. Law review hypothetical, it's not real world.
Well, that's a practical answer, that's not a principle answer.
Well, the practical circumstances don't tee up the principle question. There's no reason to
The problem with your assumption of the facts is that there are places in the United States where you are an hour away from the nearest pharmacy. And there's lots of them. I grew up in the Midwest, I've seen a ton of them. The Midwest is filled with places where there's one pharmacy. And so if the one pharmacy takes a position that it will not hand something to you, that loses its efficacy dramatically over a course of 72 hours, the state has an obligation to permit you to get that medication. That's the problem with your assumptions.
Any place that doesn't have a phone book to?
That phone book does not deliver a prescription to you.
Phone book, that's you make 10 phone calls and find 9 places that will deliver it to you.
What? An hour away? I don't know of any place that delivers to you.
I don't need to
deliver
it. May I
ask this question, kids?
Please.
Are we saying that it is merely the practicalities of the situation that determines whether or not we should have conscience clauses? You're saying hour away. You're saying just pass it back with don't refer.
I'm saying, as a practical matter, most of these hard questions never come up.
And
but if they did, then the compelling interest test would
be not an interest test.
Right. So, Judge, in all due respect, would use to answer the question. There are questions at the margins of everything.
That's my favorite answer. So, what is a compelling interest? Name one that the Beckett Fund has ever acquiesced on.
Are we doing extra topical matters?
No. He's saying that this is okay. It's a compelling interest. I want to know. He mentioned the Merced case involving the slaughter of 6 goats and actually 8 goats and 16 chickens. And in someone's home, and there the interest was the spread of cholera and E. coli, and it wasn't a compelling interest. So what
That's
is?
That's because there was no evidence that one germ had ever escaped from his kitchen.
Well, anyway, we're not going to fight this case. I know this case now. We'll fight it.
What about this? Shall we take from the audience, Robin?
Just more of a commentary question. I was fascinated by the late Senator Kennedy's letter to the Pope, and again, you have to look at the context. But given his legislative record and his political persuasion, in the letter to the Pope, he mentioned that he did in fact support conscience clause. So, just your thoughts, comments on a politician, so it's like Senator Kennedy making that comment.
About being in favor of the Commerce?
Yes, cause and supporting.
Oh, there has never been a religious exemption he has turned down, ever. Doesn't matter what the issue is. I mean, I could just give you lists and lists and lists. Ted Kennedy was responsible for a bill in a law that passed that provided a Catholic university the land of the old soldiers' home at 10% on the dollar. So, there's no surprise there.
Senator Blucher.
Yes, so a question, Professor Hamilton. You mentioned that one of the things you thought the other side was arguing was that this notion, this entitlement perspective, that the practitioner who is religious is entitled to not, do certain things. But it seems like your argument is exactly an example of an entitlement perspective, because you're saying the woman that wants to end in the hypothetical, the life of her unborn child.
No. Plan B is not an abortifacient.
Has a right to, is entitled to have someone, if they don't want to do some, give her that instrument to refer her to someone else. Well, what other situations? I can think of other situations where I, as a consumer in a business relationship, would feel entitled to have someone who doesn't want to provide me with a product or a service, where I would feel entitled on some constitutional ground to have them refer me to someone else, to their competitor, there's a 21st Amendment right for me to buy alcohol, but that means if I go to a grocery store that doesn't sell alcohol, the cashier has to refer me to the local neighborhood bar that sells alcohol.
Well, I mean, let's be more precise here, right? I mean, your analogy is the business world. We're dealing with a highly regulated medical industry, right? And so the question, that's highly relevant, right? Nobody in the medical industry handling drugs is not licensed, right? They're all licensed, and they're licensed for the safety and the welfare and the health of the people. And that's why they get the benefit of the license, because they've proven that they're going to act in the interests of the patients and not just in their own interests. So a nurse in a hospital is going to lose her license if she decides halfway through giving someone some medication that she's really in the mood for a Coke and I'll see you later. You only keep your license when you serve the health needs of those that you're serving. And so the pharmacist has a license because the pharmacist has gone to school to learn how to provide medication. And when patients come in and ask for medication, the pharmacist's obligation is to provide what the doctors have prescribed. The question here is, the argument in the United States has gotten to the point where any burden on religion of any kind is viewed as wrong. But there are all sorts of beliefs that impede people from having all sorts of jobs. And my question is where's the entitlement to the license to be a pharmacist? Right? That's my question.
Yes,
hi.
Just
to correct the record here, Plan B, you're saying, as a fact, is not an abortifacient, and it can be, because fertilization takes place between 24 and 72 hours after the sex act, and Plan B can be taken up to 72 hours, so while it may not always be an abortifacient, it can be. So you can't make that blanket statement, because we're talking about biology, and it's not about a person's opinion. Well, so I just wanted to clarify that.
You're wrong about it.
I'm actually not wrong. Maybe you should consult a biology textbook.
A what?
Biology textbook.
I don't need that. I'm talking to you.
All right, children.
Sir? Yeah, are you familiar with the case in this state regarding Mount Sinai? A woman was required to perform a late-term abortion against her religious beliefs. Now, we all know, as you mentioned yourself, Griswold was used as precedence for Roe v. Wade. So by that precedence standard that our legal system uses, could not legislatures and judges and various
branches of government say that because one person in medicine is required against their religious wishes to provide a plan B, that someone else could also be required to provide a surgical abortion or even late-term abortion against their religious beliefs, because the religious beliefs cannot deny the patient what they demand as health care.
I think the woman should not have been forced to do it. I mean, I think accommodation is a sensible thing, just as I don't think that there needs to be the accommodation of the pharmacist. If there's a situation, here's a more troubling situation, at least from my perspective. Let's say you have a woman with an ectopic pregnancy, which can cause her death, and she's in an ambulance. And she pulls up to a hospital, used to be a community hospital, that's been taken over by the Catholic hospital system, which is not an unusual scenario. She is close to being in a situation where if she doesn't get into surgery, she's going to die. Should the Catholic hospital have the ability to turn her away and force her to go to another hospital, or should the Catholic hospital be required to provide whatever treatment is needed in order to save her life? That's the hard question.
You get the wrong hypothetical. For a Catholic physician, clear for decades, ending an ectopic pregnancy is not an abortion.
Well, we have two cases where they turned the woman away.
What's the difference between the gentleman's scenario with the doctor being required to provide a late-term abortion and the pharmacist scenario?
The nurse.
I'm sorry?
The nurse.
The nurse.
Nurse.
The nurse. There isn't any difference. I mean, my point with respect to the pharmacist is that they should have to refer. The care should have to be there. The whole point, whole argument, is based on the fact that at one point they were accommodating her, and then they quit accommodating her. And so she's saying there were other people that could have fulfilled the medical need. So long as there are other people to fulfill the medical need, I don't have any problems with people exercising their conscience. But my point is solely, when push comes to shove, if no medical treatment can be provided, in that circumstance, I do think you have to go the way of the healthcare choice and not the way of the conscience.
Jerry?
Professor Hamilton, you have said that this is not a constitutional issue, but solely one of diversity and whether the accommodation of religion should control over the needs of an individual. I must say that I thought that the Constitution applies here. First of all, your statement that a medical or pharmacist license is not a right, it is correct, but there is a constitutional rule, isn't there, that a discretionary license granted by the state cannot be denied on unconstitutional grounds. And that's a Supreme Court ruling. And second,
I'm just perplexed by how it applies here, that's fine.
How it applies here? I will get to that. The fact is that state action, which requires someone to do something contrary to what his or her beliefs are, and associate with an organization or a theory with which he or she does not wish to associate, is also a violation of the freedom of association. Now, you have a situation here, and I want to ask you this question based on all of that. Do you say that a lawyer who is licensed as much as a pharmacist, if not more, has to take a case defending an abortionist defendant charged with murder? Does a doctor who is in a hospital who is registered, who is also licensed, have to do an abortion because there's no one else within 100 miles who will do the abortion? Or is there a right, a constitutional right of individuals to say, I will not do it, I will not refer because it's against my views, and I don't want to be associated with someone else who does either do abortions or provide medicine that is an abortion method?
No, I mean, the Supreme Court's cases do not stand for the proposition that if you have a belief which is in conflict with what the law is requiring you to do, you don't have to do it. That's Gillette right down the line. There's an individual who doesn't want to serve his country, and he wants to be part of the conscience clause that keeps the Quakers from serving in war. He doesn't get the right to do that, and the court makes it very clear that duties that collide with beliefs, if they are part of duly enacted legislation, are duties nonetheless. That is precisely what Gillette said. And Employment Commission v. Smith says exactly the same thing. Neutral, generally applicable laws like licensing requirements are imposed on individuals whether or not it conflicts with their religious beliefs. There is no constitutional right the way you described it. Now, perhaps you're thinking about the cases that say that the government may not compel you to say something and may not compel you to believe something. Now, you have an absolute right to believe anything you want, but you do not have an absolute right to do anything you want under the United States Constitution. And if you choose to be a pharmacist, you can be regulated by neutral, generally applicable laws. I don't think there's any question that licensing requirements are going to be upheld. Now, here's the problem with your lawyer hypothetical. The question is not whether a lawyer would have to take a client they don't want to represent. Obviously, we know the answer to that. That's kind of silly. The question is, as you're representing something, if you find out that you need to make an argument in the midst of representing them about a law that you have to take a position that's against your religious beliefs, can you then decide not to zealously represent your client? Right? That's the question. And for the lawyer, what's the lawyer's choice there? Withdrawal. The lawyer's choice there is to say, you know what? I can no longer in good conscience continue to make the arguments in this case. I am not the lawyer for you because I cannot be the most zealous representative of your interests. I withdraw.
Is that what the pharmacist does?
No, that is not the... No, the pharmacist doesn't withdraw from the practice.
No, not from the practice. Neither does the lawyer. Neither does the lawyer.
Yeah, no, the lawyer withdraws from the case.
That's the specific patient.
No. The withdrawal by the lawyer can only be permitted by the court if there's a replacement. That's my simple point. There must be... I've never been able to withdraw from a case unless I certified to the court that there would be a replacement, ever.
Well, what would be the response if we're not discussing contraception? Something like, let's say, a devout Islamist who doesn't want to perform life-saving surgery on an apostate. That's in contrary of his or her religious beliefs, but clearly he does not have a constitutional right to not self-service the patient. So actually I'm sorry, I forget your name from the Beckett Fund. How would you respond to that? That's a so-called principle exemption.
Let me give you maybe some better facts. In Michigan, taxi cab drivers are licensed. And one of the requirements of licensing is you take all comers. The challenge in Michigan is Islamic Muslim cab drivers don't want to carry people transporting alcohol or don't want to transport people with CNI dogs. That's a great fact, and I think that the nub of the question. And it's not an easy answer because, on the one hand, one wants to maintain that lawyers, the doctors, with serious, momentous questions of life, have to be able to observe their consciences. Same time, one wants to be consistent. And how to draw the line between someone thinks a dog is going to make his cat virtually unclean? And why is that less important? I don't know. I struggle with that question.
Well, I mean, basically, what happened in Minneapolis is that the city council said that cab drivers who are Islamic don't have to carry liquor of any kind because they don't believe in drinking. Then it turned out you couldn't get a cab from the airport. The city council had reversed itself, and literally, from the assistant, I'm not making this up, they had reversed themselves because you can't have a license. It's a service to the public to take people in your cab. And if none of the cabs are picking people up, we're showing up from California and France with cases of wine, then the service has ended. They reversed themselves, and what's interesting about this situation is the imams, the local imams, then issued a letter saying that the cab drivers had misunderstood, that they don't have a problem carrying unopened alcohol in the cars.
Sir?
Is the position that you're reaching towards that it's the fact of regulation that gives the state the ability or the right to dictate to anyone who is licensed in any particular profession to engage in whatever conduct is legal, although against that person's conscience? I mean, I thought of a couple other examples, actually the Muslim taxi driver was one of them, but in most states, butchers are licensed by the state. Suppose you had a Hindu butcher who won't touch a cow because they're sacred, and you have somebody who says, comes to the only butcher shop in that town, and says, I'm starving to death, here's a cow, if you don't slaughter the cow, give me the meat, I'll die. Or, you know, make it a Jew and a pig, doesn't matter. There are butchers who are licensed to have...
They're not professionals.
Or, you don't think being a butcher is a profession?
It's not.
There are some states where flower arrangers and florists are licensed and regulated by the state. If somebody comes into a florist shop and says, my cousin just died, I need a flower arranger. I'd rather
go back to the example of a surgeon. I don't think it changed the answer to the question. The question was, what happens if... What about the Islamist doctor who refuses to perform this life-saving surgery?
The reason I was bringing up these somewhat exaggerated examples was to make the point that, is it the reach of regulation, of licensing, which gives the state the right to dictate behavior? So whatever occupation is licensed is subject to the dictates of the state. Is that the position?
Is the law, yes. Yes, it is. And how do you get to the law? You get to it through lobbyists asking for certain aspects of it. And we have many, many exemptions because religious groups are so effective at lobbying. And so I think we're actually dealing here with a non-problem. The question is whether or not there are circumstances where the state can mandate that a health provider provide something to a patient in the patient's time of need. That's really the hardcore question here. And I say absolutely that as long as this doctor must perform the life-saving operation or he loses his license. Right? Now, if it's on another day, there's three other doctors available. Accommodation is a wonderful thing. You can't object to accommodation. What you can object to is excessive and one single-minded accommodation that leaves all other interests to the side simply because it's religious.
Sir.
A comment and a question for both panels. In terms of a constitutional right to burden a license, clearly I think everybody agrees that there isn't a constitutional right to a license. But well into the 20th century, Maryland was refusing to give licenses to notary publics to atheists because they couldn't comply. And that was held to be an unconstitutional burden on the license. Now, we have progressed to the point, it's progress or not, just use the word for the purpose, where somebody with an equally principled view, at least, is being asked to affirmatively do something that they believe that they're not entitled to do from a religious or a moral basis. Now, what I'd like to be clear about is back in 1879, when Roe versus the United States was decided, the court spoke in terms of a belief action doctrine. Should there be a constitutional difference between action and inaction? Is it constitutionally significant that you are asking somebody to affirmatively do something? Because you can stop the Muslims of the 19th century from engaging in polygamy by criminalizing it, but they're going to have to affirmatively act. isn't it more invasive to say that somebody has to actually do something, act affirmatively to commit an abortion or involve themselves in prescribing Plan B, as you prefer to call it, but whether or not it's an abortion mechanism or not, obviously there's a strong difference of opinion between you and the young lady. Is there a constitutional difference between action and inaction? And I'd like to get both of your responses.
Don't rush.
What's good about speech, what's good about speech is its freedom from both censorship, being silenced, being compelled in there. I don't know that compelled speech is a worse offense against the First Amendment than censorship is. Compelled action worse than forbidden action? I don't know. I suspect it's going to be, at the end of the day, especially we would be drowning 10 feet of water, drowning 20 feet of water. Once it's unconstitutional, it's unconstitutional. I don't think it's going to get us anywhere. It could be wrong.
I don't think that boundary line helps a whole lot. And let me give you an example. Religious parents are under an obligation to provide for their children both food and medical care under every state law. They're also forbidden from abusing their children. In the one hand, the state is prescribing action. You must take action to save your child's life. It doesn't matter what state you're in, even if you've got medical neglect exemptions. You can't let your child die with no repercussions.
But who has a moral view or religious view that letting your child die is
religious? It's litigated every year. There are three cases pending right now where the parents knowingly let their child die for religious reasons.
No, what they did was they substituted something they thought would be as efficacious, and they were mistaken about that.
Exactly.
And,
well, that's an interpretation. That's a rational interpretation.
This gentleman here and then the gentleman in the blue shirt, I think that's probably it.
Yeah, let me just make sure I got this life argument correctly, because Professor Hamilton, you were making the argument about that a doctor would absolutely have to operate on a woman to save her life. I think we all agree pretty much with that. Can't the same argument be used for a pharmacist who says, by issuing this pill, this medication, he's endangering the life of a child. The child hasn't been born yet, but the woman wouldn't be going to the pharmacist if she weren't sure that there would be a pregnancy.
No, the Plan B pill is to prevent the pregnancy from happening, not to get rid of the pregnancy once it happens. That's why it has to happen within 72 hours. It's totally ineffective after that, and it does not provide an abortion after.
Here's what happens. This is truly the answer. It prevents ovulation if ovulation does not need to occur. That's how it prevents the fertilization. If ovulation has occurred, it prevents implantation.
I'm not going to get into the medical part of this. I know it backwards and forwards. I was one of the people in the storm in this case. I'm just not going to get into it.
Because he's silly, sir. Miss.
Thank you. This is for you, Ms. Hamilton. I'm a Catholic physician, and I work in the area of women's health. I've never prescribed a birth control pill. I am starting a center for women, and as I worked starting the center, women began to call me and tell me that they have not gone to the doctor for years, because they have not been able to find a physician in women's health that they felt they could trust, because every doctor they meet challenges their values, that they can't be open about what's going on in their life. And so they've actually stopped going to the doctor. And so you brought up the point that in the pharmacy analogy, there are two individuals, each claiming rights, and the woman in that situation is being denied access to care. if we use licensing as a means to weed out those physicians who don't have the culturally accepted norm, who is going to serve the women that are coming to me as a physician? And is there an alternative to make sure that all of those people have access? Because if I am forced into doing these things that are contrary to my deeply held religious beliefs and that allow me to serve a subset of women, who is going to serve them?
Well, I mean, I have not taken that extreme position. Hardly, far from it. But if in your practice you had a woman in front of you who was about to die and you had to use, for some reason, birth control to save her, I would say take your license away if you didn't save her life. But other than that, I mean, good for you. That's awesome. I'm glad you're starting a practice that's making women feel more comfortable and go to the doctor. That's wonderful. But that does not, there's just no argument against a reasonable middle ground where the extremes are not served.
Just on that, I understand the pharmacy analogy you used was extreme, but I can tell you, having just gone through medical training and reading almost on a monthly basis what is being published in medicine, that it is the neutral middle ground that is actually being attacked. And even with the conscience laws that currently exist, then in many cases they're not offering actual protection. So if people were taking the position that you have just said, that it's the extremes we're trying to avoid, this probably wouldn't be the debate that it is, but it is happening in the neutral ground.
Well, I mean, you'd have to be more specific for me to be able to respond, which is fine.
We can try afterwards. Ladies and gentlemen, would you help me thank